Right, so once again, so with this quiz, so let's think of this quiz on Christianity. But it's not an attack on a specific religion, because that's not our purpose. You don't ascertain the truth by attacking false methods and approaches and philosophies. Because even if you did, you'd never be able to outrule every false possible philosophy. Maybe there's another false one that didn't come into being, come into existence. So you can't ascertain the truth through that method. Moreover, even if they were all given, and you could ascertain the truth through the elimination of the false philosophies and false methods and false approaches, you still wouldn't really know why the correct one is correct. You'd only know that it is correct, but you wouldn't know why it is correct, you see. So the true method of analysis, of investigation, is to directly investigate the true area and to show why what is true by virtue of itself, not by virtue of the fact that the others are false, you see. So it's not our purpose here to attack Christianity, but on the contrary, it's our purpose to elucidate and clarify some particular concept and idea, you see. And we will do it, through, it necessarily involves Christianity. Okay. Now, the basis of this class, the basis of this dissertation is that a person and life can only arrive at a true way of life, at a good way of life for himself through two basic processes. Two areas of knowledge are necessary for him. One area of knowledge is the area of knowledge regarding the self, regarding himself. And the self, a person, his psyche, is not something which is very simple. It's a very complex, complex system, complex mechanism. And therefore, it is necessary, in order to understand it, one must have knowledge, in order to understand the human mind. So, in order for a person to have a good life, we maintain that a person cannot just follow his emotions in order to have a good life. Just like a person cannot follow his emotions with regard to an automobile, if he happens to feel that if he does a certain action, you see, when the car doesn't start, if he kicks it or something, you know what I mean, that it'll start, you see, and sometimes it does work that way. But even if it did work that way, if somebody would tell you, they'd say, well, I'll tell you what to do. Kick the car two times and it'll start. You'll say, well, what basis do you have for this? Well, I did it once and it worked. So you say, well, it's possible that it worked, but the reason that it worked is because there are certain mechanisms involved in the engine, and if somebody would understand the engine, they'd be able to elucidate and clarify and show you why exactly that worked. But the person that did it could be under the influence of a certain feeling that this is the way to do it. You know, like this is the way to, you see, it's often a joke, like when you have a machine that doesn't work, kick it and it'll work, you see. What is the joke? The joke is really based upon the fact that there's a certain feeling that a person has that without any knowledge and without any understanding of it. Just by doing a certain action, it's going to work, you see. And when it does work, sometimes it does happen, this enforces this this person's type of approach, this person's approach, you see. And a person feels that it's a negation of all knowledge, you know. And this is the way that that it'll work. Now, this type of emotion, if you know what I'm trying to describe, a certain emotion. And this type of emotion, you see, it's true that people have these feelings, have these emotions with regard to mechanical things, but then nobody would really express this idea seriously to anybody and suggest that this is a way to do it. It's a joke, because in a joke, it could survive, because there's a certain amount of humor attached to it, which means that the person admits it's not really a part of reality, but nevertheless, it's a certain feeling that the individual has. Now, what happens is like this. This feeling, however, when it comes to life, when it comes to living life and understanding how to live and what the best way to live, this joke becomes a reality, you see? Most people live with the philosophy of this joke. They just have this feeling, you know, this is the way to do it, and that's all there is to it, you know. They don't want to accept the fact that if an engine of a car requires knowledge in order to understand how it functions, kavachomer of the mind. And just like you have very little chance in repairing the engine without any knowledge, you certainly wouldn't trust anybody who used any of those aforementioned methods to fix your automobile, right? So you certainly can't trust this method and this approach with regard to life and living and how to live the best life, you see? Nevertheless, strangely enough, when it comes to life, most people are just like the individual who kicks the machine, who kicks the record player and it works, and reinforces his feeling and his idea, and he's very happy to content to live like that, even though it's a gross absurdity, you see? But unfortunately, that's the way people are, for some reason or other. There's a certain emotion there, which we have to understand and analyze, of course, you see, subject to analysis. But there's a certain emotion there that clouds the mind and gives a person that feeling that in life there's no need for this, you know, you just go, you know what I mean? Just whatever feelings you have, that's the way to live. The basis of this discussion that we're having here is that there is that such an approach is false, you see. That's the premise we're laying down. Now, we're laying down a premise like this, that in order for a person to have a good life, he has to understand the machine, he has to understand himself, the psyche, he has to have knowledge of the psyche, and then there's another kind of knowledge he has to have. One more kind of knowledge he has to have. He has to have knowledge of philosophy. What is philosophy? Philosophy is an objective analysis of the different ways of life, the different options that he has with regard to how to lead his life. Now, if a person has both these areas of knowledge, then we say, and only then does he have the possibility of living a correct life. Because he has to understand himself, you see, and through knowledge of himself, he'll know what he is capable of and what he's not capable of. And then if he understands what the different ways of life have to offer, he'll be able to know, insofar as himself, which is the best way of life, you see. One without the other wouldn't do. Because if a person understands how he works and how his mind works, fine, he understands, oh, well, what does he do now? See, what does he do now? Which way of life does he choose? In order to choose a way of life, he has to really know what lies before him. Just like if a person understands how the engine of a car works, he's going on a trip all alone and he has to know how the engine works in order to be able to repair it himself. So once he knows how the engine works, that's not enough. He has to know which highways he could travel. He has to be able to map out his course. You see? So the person has to have knowledge of philosophy in order to know which highways lie ahead of him. See, which avenues lie, what are the options in front of that lie before him? Once he knows the options, then knowing his psyche, what his psyche can perform, what it could do, he could know how to apply himself. But without these two areas of knowledge, a person really can't function. And the only way that people really, on the average person doesn't have any of this knowledge, yet the average person considers himself pretty secure when it comes to philosophy and a way of life. Feels he knows what he's doing, you see. That feeling is just like the guy that kicks the machine. That's the way most people live, you see. And in Yadus, we maintain that this is, that the objective of Yadus is to annihilate that approach and to bring a person to the recognition that that approach is nonsensical. That's the approach of the fool. But a wise man does not operate that way. And we'll get back to that a little bit in a little while. Okay. Now, the question, the discussion, really this is a repeat because we discussed it before. I was discussing with some of the fellows the other day. But what we were discussing was Christianity. Okay? Now, Christianity is something which we see, first of all, has a very widespread attraction. Now, what we have to understand is, what is the cause of this widespread attraction? Because countries have become Christianized almost overnight, in a matter of days, weeks, you see. And people have accepted it very readily. The world at large has accepted it very readily. And whenever the world at large accepts something very readily, you can be sure it's not due to careful analysis. Because the world at large aren't made up of people who make careful analysis. And things that spread very quickly, you see, there usually is some attractive point, some psychological attraction, which draws them to that thing. And we're just discussing what this is and what the attraction is in Christianity. Actually, as I said, this is not limited to Christianity, this discussion, but hopefully it will shed light on the on the nature of man, you see, and it'll be and it'll be helpful in many areas. Okay. Now, what we were discussing was this. You see, in order to understand, before you approach Christianity, you have to understand, really, the nature of the human psyche. If something is very attractive, that means that it draws its power of attraction from a certain part of the mind, usually a primitive part of the mind. By primitive, I mean this, that which is infantile. Primitive man is really an individual who is involved in a certain infantile stage, you see, and in primitive man's adulthood, he still hasn't left certain infantile forms of understanding reality, or relating to reality, I should say. All right, now, one of the most basic concepts with regard to man's nature is the way he relates as a child to his parents. You see, it's very important. I'll show you why. The fact is like this: that a child relates to his parents. It's a little more complex than the way I'm going to present it to you, but this is the basic idea. Basic idea is this: that a young child, really has a very strong desire for his mother. See? And the desire for his mother is of a sensuous nature. Now, simultaneously, recognizing his position, he realizes pretty quickly that his father, you see, is standing in the way of this relationship. Because the father is the one that really, that actually has the mother, that is actually in control. So he develops a certain hatred towards the father. See? It's called a death wish. Of course, this death wish, and when we say death to the child, it's not the same feeling of death that we have as an adult. The death to the child really means removal of the father. You see? Later, of course, he starts to realize how horrible the idea of death is and feels very guilty about his innocent wish that his father should disappear. And because of that, this wish becomes unknown to him through a process known as repression. Repression is a certain process that can push out of the mind certain ideas which the mind finds intolerable. Okay? Now, interesting is like this. Then, after the child goes through these two things, first he has the attraction for his mother and the death wish for his father, then a process of repression comes into the picture. The repression stops him on both counts, and he undergoes sort of a state where there is little activity in this regard. Little activity, really. Latency period, they call it. Okay? But what happens is like this. Around the age of 13, these processes become activated again, you see. But it's interesting. At the age of 13, when these processes become activated again, they don't become activated in exactly the same way as before, yet they follow the patterns of the earlier relations, you see. The same people aren't really involved. But suddenly, around the age of puberty, around 13, 12, 13, 14, around that time, we'll take a young man, for instance, will suddenly find that he's attracted to girls, you see. And also, he will find that he's a little bit rebellious about the society and that he finds himself in. He's overcome with a certain emotion of rebellion, you see. Now, these two emotions that he has, attraction to women and also the rebelliousness, really is a repeat. He's merely repeating that which he went through in the first stage, you see. But what is the difference? The difference is, in the first stage, it was in relation to a particular person, his mother, and another particular person, his father. Later, it's a substitute that comes into the picture. Now the young man thinks that this is just an inherent attraction. He has no realization of what happened before because he underwent the period, the latency period during which he was, the ideas were pushed out of his mind. So he thinks it's starting now. He just feels the attraction. He doesn't know what it's from, what the cause is, you know. And he just feels, somehow or other, he feels that this is some inherent, inherently good thing, and he pursues it. You see? The same way with the rebellion. He doesn't realize that he's merely acting out the emotions that he had at the earlier stage. He's acting out towards substitutes in the second stage. But the truth of the matter is that there's nothing new over here that is just, you know, that he just became imbued with. He's just acting out something from the past. And he's under the control of certain forces that dominated his life at an earlier point. You see? They dominated his life at an earlier point. They went underground, and now they appear again. But when they appear again, they appear not with the exact same content, but with another content, substitutes for the original people that were involved. Okay? All right. Now, so you'll tell me, so what's the importance of this? The importance of this is very great, because I think that the only way a person can, in life, can really know how to direct his life properly is through knowledge. I'll show you why this knowledge is very important. And I think the knowledge that an example of this will, for example, from this area, will really be applicable to every area of life. Okay? In Yahadus, if a person doesn't understand something, so a person like I mentioned, a young man that's overcome with these emotions, he feels that this attraction that he has, desire really to fall in love, is a very good thing. Okay? He feels it's inherently good, and he pursues it. Now you see, when a person feels that something is inherently good, and he pursues it, he really is in great danger, because this means that he didn't analyze it. And the truth of the matter is, he might be drawn by something which is really very harmful to him, very wasteful and very harmful and very depressing. But since he didn't analyze it, he thinks that this is the good. And unfortunately, our society is one in which values are made just by emotional feeling. And that's what's projected in society as a value, something that you feel. Hollywood picks up on this, and basically they lay down the philosophy for the whole society. Or I should say they cater to the philosophy of the society. They expand upon it and project it and glorify it to the point where everybody in society who actually accept it, but they couldn't really see it that clearly, they couldn't verbalize or formulate it as well, project it as well, they become, again, re-imbued with these values, and this becomes their way of life, their philosophy. Because the truth of the matter is that man has no choice but to be a philosopher. Because whatever he does, he has to feel he's doing the right thing. So the moment he feels it's the right thing, he stamps it with a value, and therefore he says this is the way of life. So the truth of the matter is, everybody really is a philosopher. The only thing is that there are poor philosophers and there are good ones, mostly poor ones, you see. But basically, a human being is stuck. He has to. He has no choice, but he has to be a philosopher. Because he has to make a choice between a way of life. And whatever way of life he chooses, he's going to start ascribing to it that some type of good quality. You see? Nobody's going to say, I'm doing this ridiculous thing, and I'm going to go ahead and do it. That's an absurdity. This person is not well. But a normal person, whatever he does, he will always attach a value system to. If a person is a lawyer, he'll say, well, law is the most important thing in a society. I can have a society without law. A person is a physicist, physics, that's the whole universe. You see? Mathematician, what's more important than mathematics? Mathematics is the basic structure of human thought. I mean, this is the human mind. Any area that you go into, any area, any profession, medicine, helping another person. What could be more important than helping a sick person? So every individual, really, whatever he does, must have some type of justification. And because of that, he lives with a certain philosophy. That's why it's so bad to have the wrong way of life. Because if you have the wrong way of life, it's not just that you're doing the wrong thing. But actually, your soul is being influenced into believing that something which is wrong is correct. You see? So whatever a person does, there comes with it that justification and that philosophy. So, getting back to this, let's take a look at the situation. Now here the situation is like this. That in our society, love is considered a very great thing. You see? And most people, you know, not only consider it a good, but consider it worthwhile of expending a tremendous amount of energy for. Yadus, and they think not only that, but they think it's above every other value. See, love is the greatest value in the world. Yadus really does not hold that way. Yadus does not accept that. It's not that the Yadus denies the phenomenon of love, on the contrary. If you look at Shlomo HaMelech in Mishlei, you see, he clearly, and David HaMelech also, they use love as an example for certain things. But they understood the power of the emotion. But they never gave it the value that our society gives it. I think it's important for a person to know this, because a person can be very, very severely misled. Now, things like this. And halacha, of course, halacha is the proof that love is, doesn't conquer all in the yadus, is that there's halacha. A person's in love with his wife, and she sees Dam Nida three times during Bia, as a result of Bia, he has to divorce her. Okay? It's halacha. So apparently, even the institution of love, which in our society is held to be above all, Yadis demands that we conquer that emotion too sometimes, at certain times. And it is not above the halachic system. Not above the halachic system. Okay. Now, what really, if that's the case, then apparently love is not an absolute value. So let's understand what it is. It's important to understand what it is, because you see, Shlomo HaMelech spent a lot of time giving examples about love and how dangerous it could be. Okay? Now what happens like this? Let's go back to the young man, the case of the young man. The young man becomes completely overcome by this person. Say he's successful, he finds a romance, and he's overcome by the a young lady. Now, what happens to him? Well, during the normal course of events, which we all know, what happens is that he may momentarily become intoxicated and change his way of life, but we all expect that it will soon die down, you see, and that he'll come back to his senses. That's with regard to other people. But with regard to the self, a person feels, somehow or other, deep down, that his own situation will be different. Somehow, he hopes or feels that this is not going to happen to him, but he will find the real thing, which nobody else as yet has found, you see. But his intoxication will last until eternity, which is basically, Hollywood, I mean. This is the idea that there is they live for this thought, for this hope, this ray of hope, because life, it's an unfortunate commentary on life. I mean, life is so bad that a person has to live with an unreality in the back of his mind in order to survive, hoping that maybe he's going to find this thing. See, now why really is it so? But we are more sober about it, and we're trying to understand it rationally. Now, so the first thing we have to do is accept the phenomenon. And the phenomenon is that as much as people may point to a happy marriage, but nobody in their right mind will say that after 10 years or 20 years of marriage, a person feels like he did on his honeymoon. I mean, no, if somebody did, I'm sure they'd commit into an institution immediately. So we have to conclude that something has transpired here. Now, what exactly has transpired? There's another phenomenon that we also know, which is common. And since we must accept it, we have to understand it, and that is that a person, when he falls in love, he thinks that this is the only one. That's it. There is nobody else in the world. The greatest one. I mean, no end to the extolling and praise that the individual will find for this person, you see. But then after a while, this premise becomes a little bit subject to question. And if we take it a little further, we'll find that it's not uncommon that the person should leave this individual. See, especially in if there wasn't a marriage commitment and the person is young, leave this individual and suddenly find that they found another individual.
Another
same.
Only one.
Right? Another only one. See? And they can go through a series of people like this. Very strange. I mean, if the person was fooled a few times by the same mechanism, what really has happened there? You see? Truth of the matter is what happened is a very simple phenomenon, based upon the way I explained it to you before. That really, the person is looking for something. But he's looking for something not in reality, he's looking for something from the past. He's looking for his early relations, he's trying to bring back that early relations. And that's the way we are created, in a way that the first relation between the son and his mother leaves a very lasting unconscious impression, and he's dissatisfied to live without it, you see. Now when he falls in love, what happens is like this, that he finds a person who has certain qualities in his mind that approach the original qualities and the original experience that he had as a youngster, you see. Now, he doesn't really need all the qualities. Of course, all the qualities, on the contrary, if it was exactly the same, he wouldn't even be able to cope with it, because it would be the same reason why he doesn't have these feelings towards his mother anymore, you see. But enough. Once he has enough of a base to operate with, he'll project the rest of it onto this person. And that's why this person becomes so unbelievable. It becomes so unbelievable because really they're projecting onto this person things from the past, from the hidden past, you see, that don't exist in reality but have a tremendous inner force. And once they do this, they become completely overcome, you see. But what happens is like this. At that point, it's okay because he projected onto reality something from the past. But what happens is, when he approaches this person, and he finally reaches his objective with this person, and he finally has fulfillment with this individual, he will find that it's not really the same individual that he thought or expected. And the reason is very simple. Because this individual never really had the qualities that he projected. And the moment as long as he doesn't really clinch the relationship, he's just approaching, and he's hoping, and he's looking forward to the future. He didn't really experience it yet. Then he can project all these wild emotions onto the scene. But once he actually experiences it, he finds a letdown. The letdown is because the truth of the matter is it's not really that person. And therefore, what happens is it dies down, and he starts looking for another person. Why does he keep looking for another one? Because this one doesn't have it. The next one does, you see. And then when that one fails, you know, he keeps on going from one to the other. Of course, in society, it doesn't tolerate such a thing. So therefore, society must force you to compromise and to settle with one of those substitutes along the line. Take the best one and settle down, and that's it, you see. Nowadays, of course, society is becoming more free. So society is becoming more free, so the demands aren't so great, so then the natural instinct will emerge again, and the person will get involved with a series of substitutes. But basically, in neither one will he ever find the real satisfaction that he's looking for, because that satisfaction draws from a former unconscious state which doesn't exist in reality. Okay? And that's why Yahadus maintains that the emotion of love really is a fraud, the emotion of physical love. And while it has its place, I do not say it doesn't have its place, don't get me wrong, it has its place, but the only place it has is not with the wild, frenzied emotions that he's looking for, but in terms of satisfying an individual to a certain extent, but not completely. See, human beings' instincts are very complex, and the way we are structured comes out that we can never have really total satisfaction, you see? But what we have is sort of a secondary type of satisfaction. First of all, the object is not the same, That's number one. And secondly, because of the guilt of the former experiences as a child, there's a certain amount of guilt attached to the object also. So that you could never expect that in love, in a love situation, that there will be real total satisfaction. It has to always have, it always has a certain amount of pain from the guilt feelings of the early time, and also it's not the right object. You see? So inherently, it could never really be totally satisfactory. And according to Yadis, this is not a tragic thing. This is not a terrible thing. That's why the halacha says that a person, halacha demands one thing, that every emotion should be under the domination of the mind. And a person should be able to renounce any emotional desire, including the emotional desire of love. That's why I tell you, the halacha says that even if a man is madly in love with his wife, sees Damnita three times, that's it. He can't have her anymore. So he has to be able to subdue that emotion also. Because that emotion is not, we know that emotion is not considered the ultimate experience and the ultimate objective. That's nonsense. That's the world's idea. Yeah, this maintains it comes from a psychological structure. That's not the ultimate in life. There is a place for it. It does give a person a measure of satisfaction. But God apparently didn't want us to derive all our satisfaction from the instincts. And apparently, it was thought best that man should not be able to satisfy his instincts completely. For the very simple reason. If man was able to satisfy his instincts completely, what would result? He would be an animal. See? The fact that he cannot satisfy his instincts completely, and the fact that the situation which to him is the greatest emotional situation, situation of love, you see, is the greatest emotional situation, cannot be satisfied, is very good for him, because this causes him, or at least it permits him, to be guided in the direction of seeking other satisfaction, a higher form of satisfaction for his energies, for his psychic energies. That higher form of satisfaction is knowledge. And that's why the Rambam says that the Rambam quotes David HaMelech when he says, Kicholas Avani, the highest level is to remove all the energy from the area of the sexual and the area of the romantic, and all this energy should be used in the pursuit and love, pursuit of God and love of God. You see? That's Kicholas Avani. That's precisely why they use that mushal. It wasn't just used, the mushal of the, of love wasn't just used haphazardly. It's a purpose for it, because that's the way man is structured. Now, you see, I just wanted to read this is very important. This is very important, not just because it deals with the area of love, but because what we must apply it to every area. You see, I just want to read to you something from Mishlei. All right, so like this. For at the window of my house, I looked through my casement and beheld among the simple ones. I discerned among the youths a young man void of understanding, passing through the street near her corner. And he went the way to her house, in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And beheld, there met him a woman with the attire of a harlot and subtle of heart. She is loud and stubborn, her feet abide not in her house. Now she is without, now in the streets, and lieth in wait in every corner. So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him, I have peace offerings with me. This day have I paid my vows. Therefore came I forth to meet thee, diligently to seek thy face, and I have found thee. I have decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, with carved works, with fine linen of Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until the morning. Let us solace ourselves with loves. For the good man is not at home. He has gone a long journey. He hath taken a bag of money with him, and will come home at the day appointed. With her much fair speech, she caused him to yield. With the flattering of her lips, she forced him. He goeth after her straightway, as an ox goeth to the slaughter, or as a fool to the corrections of the stocks, till a dart strike through his liver, as a bird hastes to the snare, and knoweth not that it is for his life. Hearken unto me now, therefore, ye children, and attend to the words of my mouth. Let not thine heart decline to her ways. Go not astray in her paths. For she hath cast down many wounded. Yea, many strong men have been slain by her. Okay? The Rambam says that this mashal, very clearly depicted by Shlomo HaMelech, is a mashal for one idea. One idea, he says. Because the Rambam in the Akdama to the Mara explains that sometimes there, in one pasuk, you have many different ideas, and sometimes there are many psukim to convey one idea. What is the one idea in this mishle? Stated succinctly, what is the one idea? The basic idea is one thing. You see, he discerned, he looked through his window. The wise man observed through his window. He saw a young fool, basically, was going straight to his destruction. But the thing about the young fool that was going to destruction was the strength of conviction that he had, that he really is going towards the ultimate good for himself. You see? That's really what the mashal is. He is so convinced, and he is so sure, but yet he goeth after her straightaway, as an ox goeth to the slaughter, without the least idea of what his ultimate destination is going to be. See, that's the mashal. Now, why is it so? But what exactly does it mean? It means that man is subject to conviction, to the most powerful conviction, based upon his emotions. And the mashal that he gives is precisely from the area that we're just discussing, from the area of love. Because that's the area where everybody feels that this is the ultimate, you see? And therefore, conviction comes very easily in such an area where all the emotions are very powerful. It takes a very wise man indeed to be able to understand what's happening to him in this situation, and in spite of the powerful emotion, not to be influenced by it, you see? The difference, in one word, between the chacham and between the fool is that the fool, or the average person, the uneducated person, really allows conviction to flow from his feelings. The Chacham has learned that these feelings, as strong as they may be, have nothing to do with conviction. And therefore, what he does is, he removes them completely from the area of his mind that deals with conviction. And he reserves only one tool for conviction, and that is his reason. That's the difference, essentially. This difference is not just, even though the mashal of Shlomo HaMelech gives us with regard to love, you see, but of course it expresses itself in many, many areas. I don't have to point it out.
What?
The same thing with what we mentioned before. If a person understands what's happening to him, you see, in the love situation, he will not raise love to the level of the absolute life, the absolute pleasure and end of all life. But he'll recognize it's just an emotion like any other, and he'll recognize and see what's happening to him, and where he really is at in reality. Won't allow himself to be intoxicated to the point where he leaves all reason and destroys his goals and his purposes in life. You see, that's a different level. It's a different level of man. Yes. And what I want to just say is like this: I'm not going to prove it, but I will just say this much. That the question over here is like this. We showed what happens and why the person really in the love situation can never really be happy. Although he feels, we've also showed why he feels he's going to be extremely happy. It comes from something within him, not in reality. And he has to expect the letdown. But the point is this, the question still is to be raised. It's true that he is satisfied partially. See? The question is, when we say partially, to what extent? It would be nice if we could know the extent. Mostly? Not mostly? See, what is it? Truth of the matter is that it is very small. Small. It's hard to pinpoint percentage-wise exactly. But man has a tremendous, tremendous amount of energy. More energy. Much, much more. Like 70%, maybe, at least, that he will not satisfy. It will satisfy a certain amount. But mostly it will be unsatisfied. If it wasn't unsatisfied, you wouldn't have all the strivings that man has today towards other types of gratification. See, the love situation would absorb it all. But you see, obviously, there's a big city out there, so somebody must have built it. And that energy comes from the area where there was no satisfaction. If it was absorbed in certain satisfaction of love, for instance, you wouldn't see it. So you see that man, basically, mainly he will not be satisfied. Most extent he won't be satisfied from the love situation. Then what happens is he starts looking for other detours, you see? Okay. Today, you have in marital situations, you have tremendous more problems today in marital situations than in the past, and more expression of dissatisfaction. Now, of course, you could say that in the past, the dissatisfaction was there, but people weren't too verbal about it because it wasn't accepted in society to talk about these things. There's a certain amount of truth to that. But there's another factor, the one that you mentioned. That is that if a person has no other satisfaction but this, and he expects and demands out of this area all of his satisfaction in life, then he's going to find that he's going to have an awful lot of complaints about the situation. Because if a person expects and believes, and his philosophy is that this is the ultimate, and this is the ultimate life, now he gets married and he finds out it's not the ultimate. How could it be anything other than dissatisfied? It's impossible. What he is doing is he's making an unfair demand for more satisfaction out of a situation than it can ever give him. And since it can't really give him that much, so he's going to be complaining all his life. You see? This is basically resultant from a bad philosophy. See, a lot of the problems result from a poor philosophy. If he would understand that it's not built, if a person buys a car and he expects it to take off or to go across a river, and he's very dissatisfied because it doesn't, he's a fool, because the car wasn't built for that, you see. But he's liable to be very unhappy if he thinks it's supposed to do that and it doesn't. He paid a lot of money for it, invested a lot into it, and it doesn't do the job. He's going to be very upset, you see. And that is the case with the average person's life, because the average person believes and has been taught that the love situation is the ultimate satisfaction in life, and he should expect all his pleasure from that area, or a large extent, very large extent. And he finds that then he starts finding that it's not working. It's not working. He starts getting upset. Maybe it's this, it's that. Spend his whole life racking his brain, different possibilities. Go to this psychiatrist, that psychiatrist, this. See? Never be able to resolve it. Problem is, he has a false philosophy. That's the problem. Many instances, that's the case. If an individual is unfortunate and he has the wrong philosophy, and the day comes when he really achieves what he wanted, and now all the means, everything he's been doing as a means to reaching his goal are completed, now he's ready to involve himself in the ultimate, and the ultimate is a sham and a mirage, he has to be nothing other than completely miserable. And it has to lead to his own dissolution. There's no other possibility, you see. So fortunate, many times, are people who don't have a chance to really live according to the good that they imagine. Because the good that they imagine is not real. And if they don't get a chance to do it, then they'll stay alive with that hope. And they'll achieve certain basic satisfactions in life, you see. See, I just want to get back to one important thing. The mashal that Shlomo HaMelech uses with the Isha Zara, Isha Zaina, is not necessarily... I showed you how it works in the area, directly in that area, in the area of love. But it also works in the area of materialism in general. And many times, with regard to wealth, the same thing happens. That a person imagines, they gave you the example, a person imagines that if he had tremendous amounts of monies at his personal disposal, that he will be infinitely happy, you see. This again is a big mirage. Another case of a big mirage where he imagines that there's going to be tremendous enjoyment. What happens is this, yes? With the money, it works a little bit differently. With wealth, it works a little bit differently. Truth of the matter is, again, we have the same phenomena. We see people that have a lot of money at their disposal, and we always feel an expectation that they should be a little bit happier than they are. Or let me put it this way, that if we were in that situation, we would definitely be much happier than they are with their money. Right? They don't know how to use it. That's it. If I had it, I'd know how to use it. Funny thing is that the only one that has that knowledge is the one that doesn't have the money. As a matter of fact, there was a survey where the wealthier people, who were the happiest class in society? It came out the middle income is the happiest. What happens over here, a little bit different. What happens over here is like this. The person has a tremendous amount of energy that's unsatisfied, you see. And in his imagination, he wants to, in his imagination, what is imagination basically? Imagination is when a person can't satisfy himself in reality now, so he thinks of the future gratification. That's what imagination is. If a person was totally satisfied at this moment, he wouldn't have any room for imagination. If a person has just purchased something which really makes him excited, at that moment when he's so overcome by that object, you see, he's not thinking about the future, he's not making any plans. On the contrary, he realizes then that all those plans he made were for right now, you see. So when a person thinks of the future, the moment you see... Now, when a person becomes wealthy, so you'll notice they'll go through a certain amount of... why is it, for instance, let me give you back, why is it, for instance, you see a person that's very wealthy, goes into the office every day, and you wonder, what is he doing that for? If I was in his position, I'd be flying around the world, I'd be riding around in sports cars, I mean, what is the matter with this man? Something wrong with him, you see? Truth of the matter is that this person has really tried to do these things. No question about it, they've involved them, but they notice very quickly that there is a certain amount of satisfaction in it, but it's not what they thought it was, and then they only find satisfaction in a secondary quality of the acquisitions. Now, what is a secondary quality? A certain feeling of importance that they have because they have it, you see? And that's why they go to work every day, because in that situation they have the feeling of importance. The reason why they have the feeling of importance is a very strange one. It's because all the other people that don't have it and have this imagination and want it make them feel important, you see? So they live off the fantasy which they themselves have seen destroyed, but since in others it's not destroyed, so they live off that fantasy. It's an amazing phenomenon. Yeah. Now the truth of the matter is this. Just like in the sexual area, in the area of love, romantic area if you want to call it that, the person is not structured so that he can derive ultimate satisfaction from that situation. He is really not structured to derive ultimate satisfaction from the physical enjoyments themselves, you see. Because the world of the physical enjoyments is very fooling in the sense that it does not really cater, cannot really give what the person demands because of many reasons. The main reason is that it's physical. And the fact that it's physical, there's always dissatisfactions till you get the thing, and the moment you have it, you get tired of it at a very, very quickly. A person tires of things very quickly. Why he tires of things very quickly is because basically in everything he's doing, you see, he's trying to find something from the past, just like in the situation with the romance, with the love affair, you see. He's trying to find something from the past which doesn't exist in these objects. But he is trying to project it onto these objects. Therefore, the new sports car is going to be tremendously enjoyable, you see. But after a while, he's going to find that is not the thing that he was looking for. Instead of realizing that there is no such thing, what he will do is he's going to say it's the next one. And I'll go from one to the next whole line, basically for the rest of his life. And that's it.
See?
The reason why the person goes for physical enjoyments is because the earliest enjoyments are all physical. See? Chazal say the Yetzer Hara is a head start on the Yetzer Tov, because it was there for 13 years. What it means is that basically the enjoyments of the young child are a physical nature. That's why it's so difficult to pull ourselves away from it, you see. But there is one choice we have. Either we could be attached infinitely to the progression of false enjoyments, you see, and frustrations, real frustrations, or we could realize that this is not the area and we have to seek a new area of satisfaction. Now, I'm not saying that a person, I'm not saying this point, that a person should jump into the other area and say, that's it. You have to be, a person has to know how to go about it. It's a separate thing. A person can't be a, can't change himself in a day. But a person must try to the best of his ability to achieve the most satisfaction that he can out of the other area, namely the area of pursuit of knowledge, pursuit of chachma. Yes?
I think.
So, as we mentioned yesterday, just to continue, a person who is in the love situation is really not an individual engaging in a free process, as he imagines, but rather one who is under a compulsion which he really can't possibly fulfill. Now, the ancients also noticed this, because the ancients made one observation. They noticed that in certain pleasures, the satisfaction only exists as long as the desire exists. You see? Now, since the satisfaction only exists as long as the desire exists, they consider these pleasures to involve pain. As a matter of fact, it's even questionable whether or not there is an absolute positive pleasure, or whether the pleasure consists in nothing more than removal of the pain. So a person will not enjoy eating a steak when he's full. He'll only enjoy eating the steak as long as he's hungry. But being hungry is a painful experience. So therefore, he only has satisfaction as long as he's in pain. The moment the pain ceases, satisfaction ceases. So he's not really engaging in a free pleasure as he imagines. That's why the ancients veered away from these type of pleasures. They considered such people who involve themselves in such pleasures as similar to a person who would be taking itching powder and scratching himself. As long as he'd itch, he'd enjoy the scratching, you see. And that's the type of inferior pleasure they classified it. And they did everything they could to avoid it. Of course, also what modern psychology shows is really that it is not even as good as the itching powder, because the itching powder situation, a person at least has satisfaction in scratching the itch, you see, in removing the stimulus, which is driving him towards a certain action, whereas over here. And there's inherent frustration. And moreover, the ancients also considered love to be the tyrant of the soul, because it distorts the critical faculty and distorts the soul. But this has been written on this. I don't have to expand upon this. You can read it yourself. But that's why they veered away from it. But basically, actually modern psychology also corroborates this, because modern psychology considers love to be a neurotic state. There's a total depletion of the ego, and it's very similar to neuroses. But I can't go into all the different details at this point. At any rate, getting back to these points we mentioned yesterday, the main points. Somebody asked me to after class yesterday, what a person, of course, can, once a person notices that the better form of pleasure is knowledge, the question is, to what degree can he involve himself in this pleasure? Now, of course, there are very few people that can involve themselves in knowledge to a very high degree, like David HaMelech says. I mean, to really utilize all their psychic energy for that purpose. Very few people can do that. But similarly, there are very few people that can't involve themselves in a great amount of enjoyment from knowledge and learning. You see? So insofar as a person has the ability to do this, each person should do it within his own psychological ability. That's why I mentioned yesterday at the outset that a person must have two sciences in order to be able to have a good life. One is knowledge of the mind, and thereby he will be able to attain knowledge of his own mind, and secondly, the knowledge of the options that are before him, that lie before him, you see, so that he can know which to choose and to apply the proper amounts of each thing which is necessary for him. Insofar as, in other words, he could choose the best way of life, or the best activity, but he has to know himself how much of the best activity he can take, and how much he can't. I mean, what other satisfactions he needs. A person can only live the life of a human being. I mean, he can't become a malach. See, that again, it's extremism. If a person attempts just to deny his needs. Yes. So he who enjoys reality is not disturbed by the fact that he isn't as intelligent even as he wants to be. Because if he enjoys reality, then he's happy to understand what reality is and to accept it. That's the reality. The reason why a person is unhappy with himself is because he's looking forward to changing reality. Now, that's not the acceptance of reality. See, it's an attempt to change reality. But he who enjoys reality doesn't find any pain in whatever reality may turn out to be. It's an interesting thing. You find among great men that they usually sense their smallness in terms of their intellectual ability, like an Einstein or even a Newton. I mean, the great men, those who are at the frontiers of knowledge, usually recognize how little they really know. Socrates, Moshe Rabbeinu, Vish Moshe Anov Mikol Adam, Asher Pnei Adama. You see? Now, the fact Anov Mikol Adam means that he why was he an Anov Mikol Adam? Because he had true recognition of his position in the universe. And in terms of the absolute, I mean, if you're going to compare, you have to compare with the absolute. In terms of the absolute universe, God's knowledge, I mean, a person is nothing. But this wasn't painful to Moshe Rabbeinu. It wasn't painful, on the contrary. He was very happy that he understood and he saw his position. The Rambam makes a point of this in the Mara. The Rambam says, it is good for a person to know his position in the universe. So this person should not distort it. They should realize his position. We are at the highest existences. A person who's interested in reality shouldn't be disturbed by that. We're made by a creator. That is our nature, and this is what we are, and that's it. I mean, there's nothing that one can do about it. I mean, there's nothing that one should want to do about it. This is what we are. I mean, there's nothing. When a person appreciates what he is, the type of creature that he is, that's reality. If he loves reality, he's just satisfied to know what his position is in this reality, and that's it. I mentioned before the importance of self-knowledge. Because the two go hand in hand, really. Like, if a person finds difficulty in accepting something which is rational, the next thing they have to do is to discover why they have this difficulty. The difficulty has to stem from an irrational part of the soul. But the irrational part of the soul works with certain principles. See? Maybe irrational, but it doesn't work irrationally. See, it works with certain principles. And a person should try to search and discover what the source for this irrationality is. Once he uncovers it, you see, he will be able to deal with it in a much better way than if it's unknown to him, you see. The only thing that we have that really could assist us is the intelligence and the mind. And those things which are unknown to us are extremely harmful. Once they become known to us, then the mind can work them over. When the mind can work them over, then we can remove a lot of the potency of the particular rationality. Especially because the mind really does play a role. And what happens is that many things, many irrational factors within us, when they first arose at a time when the mind state was infantile and couldn't really grapple with it, you see. Then what happens is, because the mind couldn't grapple with it, it became unconscious. Then it keeps on, the instinct keeps on shooting forth from the unconscious because it has to have some outlet. However, when a person has a more mature mind and he uncovers it, and he could deal with it in terms of his mature mind, you see, then it's a totally different story. Many of those things would not be unconscious if a person had the maturity at the time of their onset. The only thing a person could do later is to bring them back, you see, and then understand them. And this way, they lose their potency. The mind has a way of discharging the potency of the particular force, because the mind can deal with it. The problem is that many of these things arose at a time when the mind was too infantile, couldn't deal with it. You bring it back, and you can remove it. Just mentioned briefly that what we mentioned Sunday was that the ancients didn't seem to be plagued with the amount of neurotic type symptoms that we have today, you know, because in today's world we see that sometimes a person might understand the true philosophy and still somehow or other they can't go along with it. You know, Chazal don't seem to talk about it, the medievals don't seem to talk about it. I maintain the reason is because they were raised in a different type of society, and if we were raised properly, truly according to Derech HaTorah, without the influence of alien nations, ideas of alien nations, I don't think we would have the problems with the neuroses that we have today. But given the fact that we have them, the only way to deal with them is through the through analysis and through understanding, like anything else. But definitely, I think that today's society suffers from something that the ancients didn't have to cope with, because you don't find in Chazal even a mention of this type of thing. Chazal seemed to discuss, you know, a person has to make a bechira to understand, you know, decide and understand which way of life is the best. Yeah, sure, there's a lot of problems, it's not easy. But the type of neurotic problems that we see today, you don't find in Chazal, and you don't find in the medievals. I think the reason is because of the society, because the society has been influenced from the outside, from other philosophies, which are very harmful in the raising of children. They're very harmful to us in our early stages in life, and we suffer from that. Christianity, for instance, is a very very evil force in this respect, because its philosophy is very harmful. See? Philosophy of Christianity differs from our philosophy in this respect. In Christianity, one is blamed for his instinctual makeup. So you can't accept the instinctual makeup. In Yadus, the instinctual makeup is a given. There's nothing wrong with a person's instinctual makeup. The question is how he deals with it. As an example, we mentioned Sunday, if you say a person was a very great person, so when you hear he's a great person, automatically you have a feeling of reverence and respect for that individual. Let's say you were to find out he had sadistic tendencies, you'd immediately lose your respect. You see? That's Christianity. If the person's instinctual makeup is of such a nature, then in other words, good and evil is determined by the instinctual makeup. That's the good and the evil. You see? Yadis does not accept such an idea. Because the Gemara says that Dovra Malach has strong sadistic tendencies, and utilize them for Melchamas HaRashus. All the Gemara says that a person that is vicious should become a Shechet. See? So the person is not blamed for his underlying instinctual makeup. Whereas in Christianity, you are good or no good dependent upon what your makeup is. Your makeup you had nothing to do with. It's an absurdity. But nevertheless, there's a tremendous amount of guilt because of the social acceptance of that philosophy. The society feels a lot of guilt because of the instinctual makeup, and that's why in early youth especially, you see, this filters down to the society in general and also to the children as they develop. And because of that, they incur a lot of problems because they feel a lot of guilt about their instinctual makeup, and they repress a lot of little parts of their personality. Once this happens, you see, then these repressed forces start generating activity at a later date, and the person is completely unaware of what's happening to him. He can't cope with them. He can't deal with them. See? But Yadis does not, that's not the philosophy of Yadis. Yadis does not maintain that way. Yadis maintains that the instinctual makeup is not man. The reason why Christianity maintains that way is because they feel, what is the man? The man is what his instincts are, you see? That's a shallow view of the essence of man. The essence of man is the soul which exists, which is something beyond the instinctual forces. And even the psyche is not man, according to Yadis. The Gemara says that Rabbi Yechanan lost his mind at a certain point. Towards the end of his life, he lost his mind. When Rish Lakish died, he couldn't find anybody to learn with him. He lost his mind. So Chazal mispala for him that he should pass away, he should die. But nowhere do you find that Rabbi Yechanan's chelek and Elam Abba was diminished because of that. If the psyche is the essence, so then he would have lost his chelek and Elam Abba, because psychologically he was disoriented. You see? But according to Yadis, the psyche itself, even the psyche itself, is not the essence of man. It's something beyond the psyche. Psyche is not the I. The psyche is only something which the I utilizes, you see, just like it utilizes the body. But there is something beyond it. And how a person deals with his psyche, that is the essence. That part stems from the soul. But the given psychological makeup is not something to be praised or to be blamed for. I mean, it's a given in nature. That's the way God designed it. But to feel guilt about instinctual makeup is a very shallow and very harmful view, you see. And that's basically the view of Christianity from which we suffer today. There's no question about it. A person might have to take therapeutic measures, just like going to a physician. But the guilt attached to that, attached to going to a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a psychoanalyst, is definitely the influence of Christianity, I mean. Because they think that's the essence of See, a person will always feel bad because or he will feel very bad if it's his essence that's being attacked, being questioned. You see, and that's the way a person feels about the psyche. He feels it's his essence. Of course, it is more his essence than his body. There's no question about that. But it's not the ultimate essence. Exactly. See, they look at once you look at the instincts as a flaw, so then the only way to deal with it is to deny it. And what happens when you deny it is you can't really wipe it out. What happens is it exerts an influence from the source at which it is, you see. Now, it is really the most harmful thing, because then the person doesn't really see what's happening. If a person understands his instincts, he can deal with them. If a person denies them, then whenever he acts on the impulse of an instinct, he's going to rationalize away why he's doing it. Because he can't accept that he's doing it for that reason. And he'll rationalize it away. You see? I'll say he's doing it for another reason, because he can't accept it's really coming from the instinct. Yet the instinct's going to seek satisfaction. That's why you have the unbelievable paradox of Christianity, that is supposedly a religion of love, which has been responsible for so much death and murder. You see? Because the point is, once you repress an instinct, if you repress an instinct to kill, so then, of course, what happens is when that instinct comes to the fore, you can't say to yourself, well, this is my instinct to kill, and I will not listen to it. Because you don't have an instinct to kill. So it must be that this isn't an instinct to kill, but this is really a religious, a holy type of activity, you see? It stems from the holy part of man. If that's the case, then you can go and you can kill, not only kill, but you can kill without any compunction. Because there's no guilt attached to it anymore. So that the worst harm comes from a denial of the instincts. Somebody one time asked, they said, how could you maintain this Bechira? If you take a look, you'll find that X amount of murders are committed every year, certain ratio, in certain types of societies. If you're going to say this Bechira, why should we have this constant? You see? Or near constant? That was a question I was raised. The answer is like this. Insofar as the instinctual makeup of man is concerned, there is no question that environment interacts directly with his instinctual makeup, you see. But you have to realize that a person is a bar hachi of bechira, is capable of bechira. But the only thing is that a person can choose not to exercise his bechira and just to live according to his instinctual nature. If he just decides to live according to his instinctual nature, then naturally he's going to fall into the realm of probability. Because that's the way the instinctual nature works, like any other phenomenon in nature. You see? And most people don't really exercise their bechira. But you're correct in what you said, that if a person would exercise his bechira, which stems from his soul, you see, then he wouldn't be subject to the probabilities, the laws of probability that are involved with the psyche. You see, the only thing is that you have to realize that there are very few people that are living like man, which means in a situation where they really exercise their bechira. There are many human beings that are just living on the instinctual life. Of course, those human beings don't really have any bechira. I mean, aren't exercising bechira. They are capable of having bechira, but they don't have in their situation. You see, or they are not exercising bechira in their situation. Whether or not it is their fault, I mean, this is something which is difficult to decide. If you take an African bushman who is definitely living an instinctual life, I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, could you say that this is his fault? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I would think it's pretty difficult. It would be pretty difficult for him to extricate himself from the society. You see, that he was raised in. But this is something which is difficult to know because you have to know degrees. And degrees are difficult to know. I would say that Bechira requires, for a person to remove himself from the instinctual, it requires a certain level of human development. Beneath a certain level, you're not going to find it. I'll tell you why, because there are people, you see, even when a person is predominantly operating by his instinctual makeup, but he might, at times, something might have crossed his path in life where he was given the stimulus to really think and to make a certain change or a certain diversion, you know? And what happens is, at that point, he definitely had Bechira. Question is, but once he decides not to do it, he slips back into his rote way of living, then there's no Bechira in that rote way. But he made that decision. You see? That's the point. That's why Yadis has so much emphasis on tshuva. Because the only greatness of man, what is tshuva really? Tshuva posits one thing, that there are two states of the mind. There's a state of the mind when it's involved in dispensing its psychic energies, you see? And there's a state of the mind when it is withdrawn from the activity of dispensing its instinctual reservoirs of energy, you see? Now, the state of the mind finds itself when it is dispensing its energy is one in which there isn't really much room for reflection. Because at that time, the instincts are working, operating. And it's very difficult to reflect at that time. Tshuva means when the person draws back from reality and he withdraws all his instinctual forces from activity and he contemplates and he thinks over the activities that he performed, you see, then the mind is free because the energy isn't being taken up by activity. And then the mind can think and reflect upon the activity and decide whether it comes from this part of the mind or that part of the mind, you know, whether it is something which is worthwhile or something which is harmful. That state is tshuva. That's why the Torah makes so much emphasis, places such an emphasis on tshuva. It's a different state. And only through that state can a person improve himself. And a person is in constant need of improvement because he's constantly subject and is prey to his instinctual makeup. You see? That's why you have tainus removed from the instinctual, correct? Man cannot live in only the active state. That will be living without tshuva. Discussing the idea of the enjoyment of knowledge. So he said that if a person really, the average person has an idea that he wants to investigate a certain area. He wants to investigate a certain area, so he wants to come up with something. That's the whole idea. If he doesn't come up with something, so then he's in pain. So therefore, he's only happy when he arrives at the solution. Without the solution, he's not happy. But the real idea of intellectual activity is a free activity. An activity where the mind rolls on freely, you see, and it enjoys the dilemma as much as the solution. Because really every dilemma is a gain in knowledge. If you enjoy knowledge, so if you have a problem, that means that you see that something you thought you understood before, you really don't understand now. So that's a gain in knowledge, isn't it? Negative knowledge is a big gain. Matter of fact, it's questionable whether we have anything else but negative knowledge, you see. Problem arises from the fact that we are so conditioned, you see, in our ethical value system, which is a terrible system. You see, because the ethical value system is really like, what it does is, it only understands one type of enjoyment. You see? other than the really sensual. It understands an egoistic enjoyment, see? So it puts everything into the same frame as the egoistic. So now whatever you want to do, now even if a person should want to embark upon a life of philosophy, that itself will become an egoistic type of endeavor, you see? Yeah. So therefore, very few people in the world, it turns out, with this, raised in this type of philosophy, there are very few people that can really enjoy pure thought. Because very few people involve themselves in thought for its own sake anymore. It's only for the sake of some type of gain or prominence or imaginary prominence, you see? Or even a good feeling that I'm doing something which is good. I solved a certain problem. That's a great thing. You might not really feel it's going to get any fame or prominence for it, but that satisfaction is the same type of accomplishment. Accomplishment, you see?
Yeah.
This type of thing. Everything is tied to accomplishment in our society. It's very, very, again, that we suffer from the effects of that type of upbringing. Einstein mentions that we start thinking for a reason.
Mm.
He says, but then once we get involved in thought, we find out that the enjoyment of the thought is greater than the reason that we sought to begin with. The person might want to build a bridge. So his motivation to get involved in thought is because he wants to build a bridge. But if he really appreciates knowledge, he might find more enjoyment in the process of thinking than he does in the end of constructing the bridge, you see? Now, it's true that in order to get involved in the thought, you have to use exert a certain amount of effort, you know? But once he gets involved, it might be difficult to get the facts, I mean, in the Gemara and whatever, but once everything is lined up and the mind is working, then the mind is involved in the free pursuit automatically, the free pursuit of knowledge. And he's unaware of anything else, unaware of any instinctual drives. Now let's get back to the thing we mentioned at the onset. Christianity. Okay.
Yeah.
Now we mentioned anything that has that's so widespread at such a rapid pace has a great appeal, and the appeal is doesn't stem from the source of Bechira, but it stems from the instinctual makeup. Okay. What really is so appealing in Christianity? All right. Now we mentioned yesterday when we first started that there is the basic complex that an individual has when he's very young is that he has a desire for his mother and simultaneously has tremendous hatred towards his father. How great that hatred is hard for us to estimate because at this time in our lives we don't have it, you see. But those who study the area estimate that it's pretty strong and that it's tantamount to a death wish. It's a desire to kill. Now, yes. That really, and I mentioned yesterday, this is a source of rebellion in early youth. Because those forces reassert themselves after puberty, after the onset of puberty, when there are new energies that are channeled into the individual. Now, the thing is like this. So therefore you find that this is responsible for a desire to overthrow the existing regime, see? Now, the difference between Christianity and Judaism is one thing. That essentially, that Judaism is psychologically I'm talking about. I'm not talking about essentially philosophically. I'm talking about psychologically, psychological appeal. In psychological appeal, Judaism is the religion of the Father, you see? Whereas Christianity, the most prominent feature of Christianity is that it's the religion of the Son. You see, because Jesus is considered the Son, and the Christianity goes to great lengths and absurdities to maintain that Jesus is the Son. See, now there must be some tremendous importance in this fact. Now, why is that so important? Okay, another feature of Christianity, and basically Christianity maintains that it doesn't really matter the type of life that you live. But really, more important is your identification with this particular individual. The important thing in Christianity is identification with this individual. Now, the thing is, another important part of Christianity is, and an equally absurd part is, that this individual died for their sins. You see? So therefore, you have a very strange type of philosophy. If you accept this individual, and you have no more sins, If you don't accept this individual, no matter how righteous you are, you see, no matter how, what type of life you live, doesn't matter, doesn't mean anything. But you're condemned. Okay? Now, the question is, however, those who have accepted Christianity are not philosophers. They're the hamon, the masses, and they found something appealing to them. A great psychologist one time asked, put the question this way. He said, we have to know precisely for what sin did he die. You see? Now, the basic sin in every person's unconscious, a person feels tremendous guilt for, is that one desire that he had in early youth, which is to kill the father. You see? Now you see the picture of Jesus on the cross. He is the Son, condemned and dying for a very great sin. It's not difficult for the unconscious to recognize in that sin precisely that his sin was that he wanted to overthrow the Father. He wanted to kill the Father. You see? So therefore, since a person is laden with a tremendous guilt about his own desire for overthrowing his father, he finds tremendous solace in the idea that he can identify with another individual, and he wants to identify with that individual for a very good reason, a positive reason also. Because since that individual is the one that's responsible for killing the father, you see, and that's why he was condemned to die, he likes that idea very much because that's part of his own desire. And simultaneously, it removes the guilt. Do you see? So, okay. The positive impetus is because what he did is something that you want to do, but you're afraid to do. You see? So therefore, you want to, you admire him, and you identify with him. You get another benefit in that by identifying with him, he has suffered the consequences of this terrible deed, and you are absolved. So therefore, it removes your guilt. You see? Yeah, that's why you have to have the myth of the Virgin Mother. Because in order for God to be the Father, so she could not possibly have conceived in any other way than directly through God. Because in that way, God is a direct Father. You see? One of the ways that a person overcomes his desire or the conflict to... One of the ways that a person overcomes the desire or the conflict to kill his father is to identify with the father and to become the father. You see? So therefore, Jesus, by becoming God, is really killing God. You follow?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's why he is the Son. Exactly. He is the Son, but he's a part of the Father. Which means, it doesn't mean he's the Son, but he's a part of the Father. It means that it means that basically that he rose to the level where he's a part of God. He's a part of God, then he's God. Of course, you have numerous absurdities philosophically with such a premise. He's a part of God. How is he God? What part? But that's no problem. You see, that's where belief takes care of these problems. The nucleus of the identification with the aggressor starts from this first childhood wish.
Okay.
I discuss with them the ideas of Christianity. They're always at a loss to explain why they forget about, they say the Father and the Son. Why they forget so much about the Father. I mean, he's only the Son.
Right.
I didn't point that out. He really has the most prominent position there.
Oh, yeah.
I see. You have to understand something, that in psychology there's another principle, it's known as negation. Negation means that a person does the exact opposite of what he is, maintains the exact opposite of what he really is doing in order to deny what's happening, you see. Now, you'll notice that Christianity emphasizes love. In word, they emphasize it, you see. Now, the reason why they emphasize it is because actually, identifying oneself with the Son who murders the Father is really, it should be the religion of murder, you see. But in order to deny this, what they have to do is say the exact opposite. That's known as negation. But indeed, they don't, unfortunately, deny it. You see, at least not historically. Actually, it's the religion of aggression and murder, you see. But the denial has to come into the picture, so you have to say love. One last feature, and that is the sexual restrictions, you see. Now, the thing is like this, that since the identification with the desire to kill and to overthrow is so strong, which is really the other side of the coin of the sexual instinct, you see, because the child's involved in early life in a sexual desire for the mother and simultaneously the desire to overthrow and kill the father. Now, since this identification takes place, the guilt is expressed in terms of the other side of the complex, which is the desire to have sex, which is a substitute for the mother. So therefore, severe sexual restrictions must be imposed. And that's why they maintain that celibacy is the perfect state. Okay? Because of the guilt of the desire to kill the father and the repression of that desire, what's necessary is to repress the motive force behind the aggression. If that would come out, if that would come out into the conscious, then it would be too obvious. So that must be severely repressed. So therefore, sexuality is repressed.
Let me
put it this way: if we should just imagine, let's just imagine. In an imaginary case, if this would take place, if a person would actually kill his father, he would not be able to take his mother because of the guilt. And that's what the situation is. The first concrete problem that this presents is that they maintain that Jesus is from the house of David. And they give the lineage. But there's one link missing. The link that involves the Immaculate Conception, correct? Anything which has emotional appeal, once one is under the influence of the emotion, you see, no amount of rationality will be able to save him. See, that's the point. But again, in Christianity, you see the detriment of denial. That's what we mentioned in the beginning, that if one denies the instinct and puts a negative sign in front of an instinct, see, he is in the greatest danger of committing the greatest evil, because he will always rationalize away what the source of his motivation is. And then he'll do it without compunction, you see. And that's basically what you have here. One more point I wanted to mention, and that is like this, that intellectuality in Christianity is really considered like a sin, because to intellectualize and to think demands a certain freedom of the mind, which is really considered by them to be a dangerous thing, and goes against the concept of belief, you see. Now the thing is this, that why is it that it's necessary for them to destroy the Jews? You see, that's the question. Well, one reason simply is one basic reason, of course, is because historically, because the Jews were there, were present at the time, and the Jews didn't accept there's a big kasha on them. But the thing is like this. There is definitely a denial in the idea that they maintain that the Jews killed Jesus. First of all, factually, it's not true. If the Jews killed Jesus, he wouldn't be crucified. But the thing is like this. The truth of the matter is, I believe that it's a denial of the opposite, which is the fact is that Jesus was a Jew and really wasn't known to the mass of Christians throughout the ages. This fact wasn't really known to them. It was denied them. The reason is because the truth of the matter is that the Jews really gave them a God. To deny it, they say that the Jews took away their God. You see. But another thing is like this, you see, a person who uses his intellect derives his conviction from reality. The reality is the source of his conviction, see? But a person who is not in the world of reality, his conviction stems from the emotional source of people. In other words, if people accept something, then it's considered true. If people deny it, then it's considered false. Because the truth of the matter is that he has no reality to go by. The only reality he goes by is the masses of people. Now, since Christianity does not really work upon a reality principle, so the only way to for them to be to ensure that what they're saying is true is by having large numbers of people accept it. See, anyone who denies it is a total threat, because it's not based upon the source of reality, it's based on the source of on an emotional source. And in the emotions, one recognizes as reality being dictated by the emotions of the people, by the beliefs of the people. So therefore, they must destroy those that don't accept it. Because anyone that doesn't accept it poses a threat that maybe this person, maybe this is correct, maybe this person is right. You see. Whereas a person who draws his conviction from reality, doesn't really matter to him whether people accept it or not. The reality itself stands in its own right. That's true. That's true. That fear, of course, correct. That fear, of course, is involved with the fact that the Jews do not accept the Son. The Jews accept the Father, deny the Son. So therefore, it is actually killing him. You see? Yeah, it's correct. Because by the denial, if you deny the Son, then you're saying that he's not that he really isn't God. He hasn't killed the Father. So therefore, the Father has killed him, on the contrary. That's true. And the Jews would represent the Father, and therefore they have to kill the Father. Exactly.
Exactly.
Since the Jews are identified with the Father, so then they have to complete the process of killing the Father. That's true. That's good understanding. I just want to mention something that I think is of practical value. That since we mentioned that the approach of Yadus is a different one than the approaches of the other religions, essentially in that Yadus does not deny what a person's makeup is. But on the contrary, Yadus insists that you recognize what your true emotions are and your true instincts, and then deal with them in a rational way. See, but the perfection is how you deal with the instincts, not what your instincts are. You see? Okay. And there's one really important mitzvah, which has very much to do with the area that we spoke about. And we mentioned the unconscious forces that exist in a child and the way he relates towards his mother and his father, you know. And the Torah also has this. And the Torah alludes to it in the fact that the Torah reversed the order.